Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Hannah Garst. I represent Defendant Appellant James Harper. The District Court clearly erred when it based Mr. Harper's sentence on an unreliable informant's statement that lacked a sufficient indicia of reliability. And this error is not harmless because the District Court's reliance on the informant's statement caused it to improperly calculate the guideline range, which ultimately affected the Court's selection of sentence. Now, the government failed to meet its burden of proof here, and that burden was to prove the quantity of drugs by a preponderance of the evidence. To meet its burden, the government put forward statements by Mr. McGee. After that initial statement, he later changed the statement by recanting and stating that the government had overstated the drug quantity. Mr. Harper learned of this through a letter by the government itself, and which said that Mr. McGee had indeed recanted the statement. So therefore, Mr. Harper objected orally and written, objection at sentencing on the basis that McGee's statement lacked reliability. In response, the government did not call Mr. McGee. The government did not call the detective that had taken both the initial statement and the later statement. The government did not call anything to corroborate the quantity of drugs. Instead, what it focused on was the fact that Mr. Harper had been involved in drug sales in the past, that he had been found with a large amount of money on him. And the problem is that this is not the issue. This evidence would corroborate the fact that Mr. Harper was involved with drugs, that he was involved with selling drugs, but it does not provide a basis for arriving at the specific quantity, which in this case was 500 grams to 1,500 grams of cocaine base. So we believe that the government failed to meet its burden of proof by, in essence, failing to call anyone to corroborate McGee's initial statement, which was relied on by the district court. Now, the district court itself erred when it failed to resolve this statement. Once Mr. Harper objected, the court should have conducted an inquiry into the government's evidence to ensure its probable accuracy, to make sure that that initial statement had some sort of reliability. Now, this statement by Mr. McGee provided the basis for 98% of the drug quantity attributed to him at sentencing. And as Robinson stated, it probably would have been a good idea from the district court to hear personally from Mr. McGee.
What was Harper charged with originally? What did he plead to?
He pled to possession and intent to deliver 5 grams or more of cocaine base.
So most of this sentence is relevant evidence?
It's relevant conduct, yes, Your Honor. Right. Now, the government asserts that because McGee made a statement against his own penal interest, that this, in essence, should prove the statement reliable as against Mr. Harper, citing United States v. Johnson. But in Johnson, the statement that was made was against Johnson himself. And clearly that makes sense, that if you make a statement regarding how much drugs you received or sold regarding yourself, then it would be reliable as against you, even if you later recanted. But we don't believe that same would be true with regards to Mr. Harper. There still has to be that sufficient indicia of reliability.
Now, McGee did this at a confession where he said it was the 90 to 120, something like that?
It was after he was arrested that the police took a statement from him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they received all this information.
Was that a confession, I guess? A statement after arrest, I assume it was.
I believe it was
after
probably
Miranda and all that.
His attempt to become an informant and reduce his own liability in the offense.
He exaggerated his purchases in order to garner favor and then cooperate?
That's possible. It's unknown why, all we know is that it was exaggerated. There was nothing further, no further questions posed by the district court. The district court basically just took the government's evidence of the statement itself, even knowing that a later statement had been made. The probation office said the same thing, that all we have is McGee's initial statement, and we know that he later changed that statement, but the government has not provided any evidence of the later changed statement.
Now, one of the things a probation officer cited to was this Charles Benson, who had indicated he had been McKee's courier for mm-hmm. a period of about 8 months. Was a specific quantity mentioned in terms of what he did as a courier?
Not that I am aware of as far as specific quantity. I believe Charles Benson was involved in just small quantities. He may have given some sort of quantity, but I do remember that he said, I'm not sure how much, you know, I delivered. There was some back and forth. But as far as Mr. Benson is concerned, he had no knowledge of Mr. Harper whatsoever and never mentioned or admitted knowing Mr. Harper whatsoever. Now, the district court also concluded that because McGee was held accountable for 900 grams of cocaine base at his sentencing, that Mr. Harper should be accountable for the same. There's two problems here. First, I believe this presents a due process problem because this would, in essence, move the burden of proof to the defendant to prove that he wasn't involved in the 900 grams of cocaine. And as this court has held, the government bears the burden of proof to prove the quantity by a preponderance of the evidence. The second problem is that the court's decision to hold McGee accountable for 900 grams of cocaine base bears no indicia of reliability with regard to Mr. Harper, especially in light of the fact that McGee, in his pre-sentence report, or assumably at sentencing, made no mention of Mr. Harper as his dealer, as the person supplying him with this 900 grams of cocaine. We believe that the district court should have resolved this conflicting drug quantity in Mr. Harper's favor because the government had failed to meet its burden of proof to prove that there was at least 500 grams of cocaine base involved as relevant conduct. I'll save the rest of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Garst. Mr. O'Shea.
Good morning. Kim O'Shea for the United States. There are two issues for the court's consideration this morning. And in this matter, whether the district court, in relying on a statement against penal interest made by the defendant's criminal confidant, was clearly erroneous. And secondly, whether the guideline error suggested by Mr. Harper is harmless, where he was in fact sentenced within a range he concedes is reasonable, and the district court provided reasons that were individualized to Mr. Harper for that 17-year sentence. The United States respectfully submits that the district court's findings concerning the drug amounts were not clearly erroneous for two different reasons. First of all, it was rooted in Mr. McGee's statement, and statements against penal interest are deemed reliable within the law because people don't make these kind of statements unless they believe them to be true. And, Your Honor, yes, this was a confession, an unprotected statement to local law enforcement officers. More than a decade ago, this court observed in Beeler and lots of other cases that drug quantities in the federal system drive the sentencing. Well, you know, guess what? Drug dealers get that too. Mr. McGee spoke first to local law enforcement officers, members of the Dane County Narcotics and Gang Task Force, and then lo and behold, his case was transferred into federal court. And it was at that point he said to the folks that he'd spoken to originally, hey, you know, those weight quantities were too high.
But he never quantified then what he considered the correct weight, did he?
Well,
I understand the district court did a discount, but we never even knew what he in his second statement actually meant by those amounts were too high.
That's true. We don't. And the investigators felt that they were confident with that first number. Remember, as you recall, and it's reflected in the pre-sentence report, they said to Mr. McGee, now let's make sure we're singing off the same sheet of music here. We're talking about 90 to 120 ounces of crack cocaine. And he said, yeah. And they said, okay, that means you made this much money. And Mr. McGee agreed again. So they felt that they had pin him down, and those statements were clearly against his penal interest. Reasonably, he regretted it once he learned that his case had transferred over into federal court. But the second reason that the district court was not clearly erroneous is because circumstances existed that corroborated Mr. Begee's statement. And the district court found that corroborating circumstances existed to include the following, that Mr. Harper and Mr. Begee had discussed on the day of Harper's arrest a 2-ounce crack cocaine transaction. However, Mr. Harper declined to provide 2 ounces in light of the fact that Mr. Begee already owed him $2,000. Now, Mr. Begee, the court recalls, said that he was buying 1 ounce of crack cocaine from Mr. Harper for $1,000, where 2 ounces would indicate not only that they had a pre-existing drug relationship, but that he was buying ounces at a time from Mr. Harper. Despite the drug debt, Mr. Harper was able to appear with a 0.5 ounce of crack cocaine on a few hours' notice. The court also gave way to the fact that a month before the transaction, in the month before the transaction where Mr. Harper was arrested, Mr. Harper had been pulled over with $25,000. And he gave conflicting stories about why he's driving around with $25,000 that a drug dog hit on. And it was not unreasonable to think that the $25,000 represented crack sales, and as it relates to Wisconsin, pretty significant crack cocaine sales, Madison, Wisconsin anyway. That'd be, if it's the same price Mr. McGee's talking about, that's 25 ounces of crack cocaine. Mr. Begee did describe Mr. Harper as his main source. There was no ultimate dispute about that. There's no ultimate dispute that Mr. Begee himself was selling for 8 months based on the statements from the courier. In response to Judge Williams' question, Mr. Benson, the courier, did not quantify the quantities he was driving around delivering for Mr. Begee. But finally, even Mr. Harper's wife told police that, yeah, she suspected her husband had returned to drug dealing. Statements against penal interest are sort of freighted with their own indicia of credibility. And here, there were circumstances that corroborated that statement. So the district, I understand Ms. Garst has some good points. The district court would have been reasonable enough to say, I decide not to believe that statement, but that's not enough to say that it's impermissible. My second point, and I'll make this briefly, I know the court's got a lot of cases, but I respectfully submit that in this instance, the district court's decision, even if there's a guideline error, is harmless. Why? Why so? Because the defense says, hey, my guy should be sentenced within 188 to 235 months. Well, the actual sentence is smack dab in the middle of that sentence. And by contending that Mr. Harper should have been sentenced within that range, the defense is conceding, hey, look, any point within this range is reasonable, and reasonability is the yardstick we're supposed to measure post-Booker. Well, the district court here, keep in mind, the defense suggests that a guideline error is the problem. Well, the district court calculated the advisory guidelines and then said, you know what, I'm rejecting the advice. Thanks guidelines, thanks for the advice, but I'm rejecting that advice, and I'm going to tailor my sentence for Mr. Harper specific to him, to Mr. Harper himself. And the district court found that 17 years was appropriate. The district court was, I respectfully submit, pretty specific in her findings. She said that Mr. Harper did pose a serious risk of recidivism, noted that a significant sentence was necessary to protect the community, to incapacitate him, and to hold him accountable, but in light of individualized factors, the court found that based on his life expectancy and his age, that a 17-year sentence was appropriate to keep Mr. Harper in custody until he's into his 60s before he began his term of supervised release. Any alleged error, and I'm not saying this is necessarily going to be across the board, but any alleged error in calculating a guideline has to be harmless where the sentencing court has rejected the advice of the guidelines and sentenced the defendant in a range that the defense now concedes is reasonable. So that's it on this case. I'll be back in a little bit unless there are any other questions by the court.
I do a little, just one touch on thing, this 100-to-1 ratio issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
Preserved, whatever. Well, I guess it's going before the Supreme Court. Is there any reason to wait for this Kimbrough case?
But for the career offender guideline, I would say yes. But Mr. Harper here was a career offender. He was sentenced within the career offender guideline range. But otherwise, the court has recently said in McCann that, you know, if the court has indicated that the court's perfectly satisfied with 101, it can go on. But here Judge Crabb said, look, she's not so sure about the 101 ratio. So but for that career offender guideline within which the defendant was sentenced, I'd say yes. But in light of that, there's no reason to hold it, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you for your attention.
Anything further, Ms. Garst?
I want to respond to that last point counsel made.
About?
Holding.
Holding it. I have to be honest that I'm not fully ready to speak on Kimbrough, so I don't have an answer for the court on whether to hold it or not. He was sentenced as a career offender. He was sentenced based on on a base offense level, but we're arguing that if this was indeed error, that he would be sentenced as a career offender. So beyond that, I'm not sure I can help the court. I apologize. As far as harmless error, we would assert that this is not harmless error. This clearly affected the district court's ability to sentence him in that they first calculated the guideline itself and used the guideline as a starting point. And this court has stated that unless the court itself makes a statement demonstrating its intent to disregard the guideline itself, then the guideline range did affect the selection of sentence. And here the district court said that it was not necessary to sentence Mr. Harper within the guideline range, but a term shorter than the guideline range itself would suffice. So we believe that they started with the guideline range first and then departed downward. So we would believe that that was not harmless. If there's nothing further, we just ask this court to vacate and remand with regards to the error by the district court.
Well, thank you very much.